This is the state of things. I'm Rusty Jacobs. When Joy Franklin went to Honduras with her church recently, it was a deeply personal trip. She was there as a volunteer to help out at a home for abandoned and abused girls. She found herself venturing into uncharted territory. As the editor of the editorial page of the Asheville Citizen Times, she was practiced at keeping her personal feelings, views, and opinions out of her work. But this time, she decided not only to send daily updates to the paper's website about her trip, but to divulge more about her personal life to her readers than she ever had before, and possibly more than she was truly comfortable with. Today on The State of Things, we're talking about how our personal passions can inform our professional lives. Must we draw a line between the two, or is it okay for one to blend into the other? When is there conflict? Joy Franklin joins us now from the studios of WCQS in Asheville. Thanks for being with us, Joy.
Thank you for having me.
And we welcome your calls this hour. The number is 1-877-962-9862. Did something in your personal life convince you to do what you do for a living? Have you ever had an epiphany that led you to change your profession? Do you think having a direct personal experience with what your patients or clients are going through helps someone do a better job? Our number again is 1-877-962-9862. Joy Franklin, turning to you as a kind of a guide, is this a problem you brought on yourself? I mean, how did you come to decide to blend your personal experience in Honduras with your professional life as an editor?
Well, I think it was sort of a number of paths that kind of converged. I was sitting in a parish meeting when our ECW president, Shirley Walsh, announced that that the ECW of Western North Carolina, which involves a number of all of the Episcopal churches in Western North Carolina, was going to sponsor a trip to Our Little Roses, which is a home for, as you said earlier, abused and abandoned girls in Honduras that was founded by Diana Frade, and she is the wife of Bishop Leo Frade, who at the time that the school was founded was the Bishop of Honduras. He's now the Bishop of Miami, but she has continued to be the school's executive director. And so Western North Carolina Diocese was going to send us a trip. And when, you know, it's one of those things when she made the announcement, I just kind of felt called to go, called to be part of it.
As a member of this group, though, not as a journalist, right?
Initially, as a member of the group, yes.
So the question is, why then take on the extra responsibility of being a journalist as well? And what issues did that raise?
Sometimes it's hard to know whether your response, exactly where your response is coming from. You know, I say I felt sort of called to go, but I don't know whether that was a response that was coming out of the journalist in me or the person that wanted to be part of this mission. That's kind of a hard distinction to make. But I did feel that this was something I wanted to do. And I, as a journalist, you know, Western North Carolina has been hit hard by trade agreements that have caused a lot of the textile jobs to go away. And I am very aware of that and had been watching CAFTA, the Central American Free Trade Agreement. You know, it'll become before Congress this year. And whether it approves that agreement or not will probably have some impact in Western North Carolina, as well as all of North Carolina. We've lost more textile jobs than I think anyone. And so there was interest from that level. There was also interest from the level that there are a number of Honduran immigrants in Western North Carolina. We have a number of Latin American and Mexican immigrants here who work in a number of agricultural jobs and other jobs as well. And so there was that connection. And then I think that as Americans, we are too isolated from the rest of the world. We have oceans on two sides of us, and then on our borders, we only have two other countries. And so I think we don't know enough about what's going on in other parts of the world. And I just kind of wanted to be a little part of increasing the communication.
Give me an
idea. So that was my journalistic interest.
Your journalistic interest. And now give me an idea of how Joy Franklin ended up showing up in the writing you were doing from there, as opposed to all the writing you've done prior to going on a mission like this.
Well, I think so far, what the readers have seen has been one column in the print version of our paper, and then a daily log on our web version and on our website. And in the print version, it's a column, and so your personality sort of always comes through in a column, I think, or can. It's certainly you have license to let that happen. On the website, it's been much more informal writing than I would normally do, I think. Much more just my personal sort of observations, little interactions. I've told stories on myself that I probably might have told in a column, but probably would never, I mean, under no circumstances would ever have included it in an editorial or a straight news story. And so, you know, sort of that kind of part of my personality has come through in a way that it probably wouldn't have if I had just gone to Honduras as a journalist with no intention of doing anything other than coming back and writing a report on what happened there or what I found there.
Did you have to convince your editors of the worth of the project and convince them that it was okay to bring Joy Franklin's personal experience more into the writing than say, they're used to?
No, I didn't have any problem with that at all. Well, I report directly to the publisher, and I have a terrific publisher who's very encouraging of innovation. And I think part of what ended up happening here, one of the other roads that was converging was our web, our online publication has been enormously successful. But that's not so much true of the editorial section of our online publication. We get a good lot of interaction in print with our readers, but we have not really been very innovative online in the editorial section. So I was looking for ways to use the online publication to create communication among people, to create community in a sense. And I'm sorry, I think you're hearing my cell phone ringing in the background. Forgot to turn it off. But so that was part of what I was trying to do. And so this was sort of an experiment. It was just a, okay, what happens if we try this? How will readers react to this? Will they like this? Will they use this? Will they go to this website, or will they?
What is the reaction so far?
Well, it's hard to say. I asked when I got back how many hits the website had gotten, and they didn't have a count for me yet. So I don't know the answer to that yet. I think this Sunday we'll be publishing another column by me and a story about our little roses that will not be personal. It will be a journalist's story. And the final day log, the final log of our final 2 days just went up today. And so on Sunday, in the print version, there will be another reminder to the readers that this web page exists and an opportunity for them to go there and visit. And we'll see what the reaction is. I think it's a little too early yet to tell. And I've gotten a little bit of reaction from readers saying they've enjoyed it. I have not gotten any negative reaction yet. But
I want to ask you later perhaps how this may affect your writing from now on, maybe in the print version of the paper. Is this going to lead to any changes? I want to broaden the conversation, though, by bringing someone else in with their story about blending the personal with the professional. Alice Wertheimer works as an event planner at TEACH, the nationally known division of UNC Medical School that treats people with autism. Alice's son David has autism, and when he was diagnosed, Alice was working as a travel agent. She joins us now by phone from her office. Alice Wertheimer, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So you were working full-time as a travel agent. You found out your son had autism. And how did that affect you in your job?
Well, it affected me in my job by, was working prior to the diagnosis of autism. The diagnosis itself isn't what affected my work. It was just dealing with a very difficult, troubling child. There was obviously something going on with him developmentally, and that made it very difficult to be at work and be worried about. I had two young children at the time, very young, and of course, I think it's difficult for any mother to be working full-time and have young children at home. We all worry about our children while we're at work, and we worry about our work when we're at home, but this made it particularly difficult because I didn't know what was going on with my son, and his behavior was so difficult that it was hard to be away from him and not feel like I should be home and be doing something to help him.
How long did it take you to decide to leave your job?
About a year. About a year when it became clear that we needed to, I needed to spend full time, all the time, make a really full time commitment to seeking professional advice about David.
Mm-hmm. How hard was that decision to make?
Well, that's a long time ago. I should say that David is 19 years old, and at the time he was 2, so it's a long time ago, and it really wasn't a hard decision because it was almost like automatic. I mean, it had to be done. I no longer could be at work. He needed full-time attention. So it was, at the time, it was an easy decision to make to leave the job. It was not a happy decision. It was not something that made me glad to leave my profession and to leave my job and to leave the income. My children came first.
Right. Alice Wertheimer, thanks very much. Alice Wertheimer is an event planner for Division Teach at the University of North Carolina Medical School. Hopefully we'll be taking up the question next about is it just too much sometimes to take your personal life into your professional life? 1-877-962-9862. The number to call. Has an experience in your life led you to a very personal career? Just ahead, getting to your calls and talking more about bringing your heart and soul into the workplace. Support for The State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners who support WUNC. This is The State of Things. I'm Rusty Jacobs. We're talking today about work. When you're so connected to the job you do, when your personal life blurs with your professional life, how do you keep your perspective? Joy Franklin is with us. She's editor at the Asheville Citizen Times. And we were just speaking before the break with Alice Wertheimer, an event planner for Division Teach at the University of North Carolina Medical School. And I'd like to pick up the conversation with you, Alice, because I really wanted to ask, does it ever get too much? Do you ever find your personal and professional lives are blended too much that you have no respite?
That's an interesting question because I have felt that way. Not so much that I couldn't handle it or felt like I had absolutely no respite, because there's always a way to take a break from your work or your personal life. But I think because I, especially when my son was younger and things were very intense with him at home, and he had some difficult behaviors, and we were very, very involved in his educational program. I think it was very intense because I was also talking to parents and talking to people at my work that were going through similar situations, and everything that involved my work involved either professionals or parents or people with autism themselves, and the word autism was just nonstop all day, and dealing with it was nonstop all day, and it did at times make me feel boxed in. But
how do you get a break then?
Well, the break is that the work that I currently do at Teach and have done for my role at Teach now and has been for the last 7 years is event planner. So my direct work doesn't involve working with people with autism or talking to parents. I mean, that's not really my responsibility. So I'm specifically working on my role involves a different kind of direction that I can sort of step back from the autism part of it. Although I'm very happy that I feel good about doing this kind of work at Teach, because first of all, I'm using the skills that I had in my former profession as a travel agent and developed them for an organization that I feel committed to and feel that we're doing important and good work.
I'd like to take a call, but Joy Franklin, I just want to ask you about that question, about whether or not the personal and professional got ever too blended. Was this an issue you ever came up against in your writing?
Well, my situation is pretty different in that, for one thing, it was very short term. For me, the issue became that because I was also participating in the activities with the girls and was in San Pedro Sula, where the Our Little Roses home for abandoned and abused girls is, and also participating in the group activities, you know, morning prayers and Compline and all the other group activities, I had and I was dealing with technology with which I was not terribly comfortable. My problem became more one of just having enough hours in the day to get everything I needed to do done. And so I ended up not getting very much sleep, and I ended up kind of running sort of out at the end of my tether a lot of the time that I was there. It was exhilarating, and I would do it again in a heartbeat. But having done it once, I would plan a little bit differently, and I would probably pace myself a little bit better. But it was more that kind of thing for me than it was I was actually, I think I was feeding on the energy that was there to a certain extent, because normally getting that little sleep, I would have been a zombie, and I wasn't.
Right, so. Talking about the trials and tribulations of mixing the personal with the professional, taking a call now from Pam in Raleigh. Pam, tell us about your work and your personal life and how they mix.
Okay, well, I am now a postpartum doula, which means I work with new mothers here in Wake County after they have their babies, helping them adjust a little more smoothly into motherhood. And the reason I became one is because I actually had one myself after my first child was born, and I was definitely blue, had the postpartum blues. I had no family around me. We used to always have our mothers, sisters, aunties, whatever, right around us to help us, and that's not the case anymore. So now I find I'm getting so much fulfillment working with these moms in that role, and it's a privilege to be able to be with these people in such an intimate way at such a special time in their life.
Was there something in your personal life that led you to this kind of work, and is that what keeps you in it?
Well, like I said, I had a postpartum doula, and she was like an angel that had, landed in my living room. And I literally filed her information away and said, in the back of my mind, I thought, I'm going to do this one day. And when my youngest child was getting near to school age, I started on the journey and got certified and trained. And I don't know, now I just... It's every client gives me so much fulfillment, and I'm so rewarded by it that it keeps me in it. It's not what my background was by any stretch, but my own personal experience just made me think this is something I want to do, and I'm doing it.
Right. Thanks for calling, Pam. Alice Wertheimer,
yes.
you were a travel agent. Now you're working with an organization that deals with autism, and you have a son that suffered or deals with autism. Does this sound like a familiar story, familiar motivations?
Yeah, that was very interesting. I totally related to what she was saying, because I felt that I was inspired and touched and helped and incredibly assisted by Division Teach, and ended up working with them, and I feel incredibly fortunate to be doing that. It's like I feel much more grateful to have this opportunity to work with people whose commitment is to people with autism and who feel and appreciate. They feel appreciation and respect for people with autism, and that's sort of the core value of the organization, and that's certainly how I feel personally. So it's, I think we all feel very lucky.
This is more rewarding in a way that your travel agent job was not?
Absolutely. I mean, it's got a much more personal, I feel like really part of a team and part of a united effort. Much more than just serving clients and making sure that they're arranged. It's a different kind of work, and I think work in itself is fulfilling, and when we're successful and good at something that we do, it feels good, but it's particularly rewarding when it has a personal interest and when you feel like you're part of an organization that's whose values match your own.
Alice Wertheimer, I want to thank you again for joining us today. Alice Wertheimer is an event planner for Division Teach at the University of North Carolina Medical School. Continuing the conversation today about people whose transformative personal experiences have impacted their work in some way, and now I'd like to bring into the conversation Ed Morrill. He's a graduate student at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill's Clinical Psychology Program. He's also a pre-doctoral fellow with the National Cancer Institute and he's a cancer survivor. Ed Morrill, thanks for taking some time to talk with us today.
Hello, Rusty.
Well, tell me about your personal experience, dealing with cancer and then how it's affected your choice, your professional choices.
Well, I guess my personal experience with dealing with cancer started in 1993 when I was an undergraduate student studying political science, and I was diagnosed with a high-grade brain tumor. And proceeded to continue being an undergrad and, I guess, eventually did some traveling and so forth.
The traveling, was that part of, your reaction to the news? What took place after finding out this your condition?
Well, I guess they gave me a fairly poor prognosis, the cancer was supposed to be terminal, so I decided I wanted to see some of the world, and over the course of the next several years, realized that the cancer was not going to, imminently kill me, and so I started looking for some different opportunities, things to add meaning to my life, and I guess I was a bit of a bohemian at that period, and so I started doing some volunteer work for pediatric oncology camps and pediatric HIV/AIDS camps, and realized that I felt sort of a calling to continue that work.
And the calling and the path led to clinical psychology. I'm wondering why you ended up choosing clinical psychology, and had you considered other possible routes, like something in medicine, in pediatrics, as you said, or oncology?
I had considered medicine and also education. I found a calling to actually work with kids, and that originated with cancer-surviving kids. But I guess what I was drawn to is helping people dealing with the situation, and so I pursued an avenue of psycho-oncology, dealing psychologically with the effects of cancer diagnosis and treatment and survivorship.
And I'm wondering if you are concerned at all that you'll ever come to the point where, you know, you just want a respite from what you're both living with as a survivor and what you're living with as a professional.
Yeah, I guess it's possible that at some point in the future that may happen. At this stage, it feels sort of empowering, and I guess it's really what gives me the energy to do what I do. I'm highly invested in research in the area, and it's basically it gives a purpose to life.
And talk about how you bring your own experience into the experience you have with patients, and how that helps with those interactions, helps or doesn't help. What effect does it have?
Well, I think in some cases it doesn't help, in that it makes it a little bit difficult to deal emotionally with certain situations, which is not necessarily what someone needs at that particular moment, but in a lot of ways it enables me to really be able to at least say in my mind, or with my actions and other words, that I know what you're going through, and that this is going to be okay, or you're going to be able to deal with this and it can be done. And I think that's a really important thing that we don't always transmit in medical situations.
Ed Morrill is a pre-doctoral fellow with the National Cancer Institute and a graduate student in the Clinical Psychology Program at UNC Chapel Hill. Ed, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Rusty.
And we're talking about blending the personal with the professional, taking your calls. Have you brought your personal experiences into your work? Have you changed the work path that you were on because of your personal experiences? Call us at 1-877-962-9862. Joy Franklin has stayed with us on the line. She's the editor at the Asheville, or an editor at the Asheville Citizen Times, and found her personal life blending with her professional one when she was in Honduras. And I'm wondering, Joy Franklin, now that you've kind of had this experience of of bringing yourself into the stories you've been providing for readers. Are you going to make sure you continue to do that in some way?
Well, I think it's probably not in this way, although it's a little early to tell. I mean, as I said, this was an experiment. And, you know, the journalist, one of the things that most journalists try really hard to do is to keep they try to remain objective and not be involved in the stories that they cover. They try not to be a part of the story. And it's kind of an unprofessional thing to become part of the story. And so that's part of why I'm conflicted about having done this. But on the other hand, I think the media is changing, and we are now finding anybody with who has a laptop and can pay for an internet account can put up a web page and become a reporter. I mean, even though there was after the Hutchins Commission, a sort of a push to credential journalists, that was something that most major media organizations objected or opposed, and it never came to be. And so we are not licensed like doctors or lawyers, and you don't have to have any specific credentials to be a journalist. You do have to have usually some experience or training to get hired by a news organization, but so I think the way the media has changed and the way technology has changed the media, you know, there's some blurring going on. And one of the things that encouraged me to do what I did in Honduras was blogging. I was really thinking about putting up a blog site. And we don't have blog technology yet, although it's coming. And so, I mean, blog software that was available to me to use. So we did it in a slightly different way, but it was just a different version of something like blogging. And so I think we're just experimenting and feeling our way. So when it comes to the question of whether I'll do it again or not, or do a version of this again or not, I think to some extent it will depend on how this experiment works and how it turns out and how I feel about it after it's done. And whether, you know, so far I haven't had that kind of queasy feeling of that we're doing something that's maybe not quite okay. I haven't had that feeling. But if I got that feeling, I'd definitely not do it again. I was, on the other hand, thinking that maybe we would be creating a template for other groups doing things in North Carolina or in Western North Carolina, maybe not mission trips, but maybe mission trips too, who would be able to use our website as a way of communicating with the folks back home. One of my goals was, you know, there were women from churches all over Western North Carolina, Diocese of Western North Carolina, who were on this trip. So one of my goals was to make it possible for their churches, the people and members of their churches, to follow the trip and to follow what was happening, what we were doing on a day-by-day basis by going to our website. And I think that's a way that our website might be able to be used that would make it possible not only for those people who might be personally involved or personally connected to the trip to follow it, but other people. And there was a sharing of information about Honduras that is a little different than what you would get in a straight news report. Right. So that was part of what we were trying to see how that would work.
Okay, talking about the experiment of bringing the personal with the professional, 1-877-962-9862, welcoming your calls about bringing your personal life into your professional life. And right now, Hazel McHilliard is on the line with us. She's the daughter of sharecroppers from South Carolina. She grew up in Winston-Salem's Happy Hill Gardens public housing project. Currently, she's the managing attorney of Legal Aid of Winston-Salem, and she's heading up a statewide mortgage foreclosure prevention project. Thanks for joining us, Hazel McHilliard.
Thank you for having me.
So you've been an attorney for 25 years,
yes.
Recently moved to Winston-Salem to head up the legal aid office there. And tell us to what extent that reflects who you are and where you've come from.
When I left law school, I wanted to be a part of legal services. It was the arm of the legal institution that reflected most of what I wanted to do. So when I left law school, in 1980, I joined legal services in Philadelphia. I later moved to Winston-Salem and practiced here for many years, went out to the East and practiced there for a while with legal services, and now I'm back home. And it reflected, I wanted to use whatever I would do as my life's journey to aid my community, and I think that I've been lucky enough to be able to do that.
How familiar are your clients' experiences and lives to you and your personal experience, and how does it help if there is a familiarity there?
Well, it's very familiar. I came up quite poor, and we service people who are poor. I guess it's a general understanding of the deprivation and the degradation, even, that people who stand in the midst of a lot of wealth but yet not being able to reach it. Many people are locked outside of that, and so I understand what that means. So I, in my work and in this institution, try as much as possible to foster that understanding, so that people do not have to feel that way when they come to us.
And Hazel McHilliard, I'm curious if you think your job is, or you're able to do your job perhaps more effectively because of the blending of personal and professional, as opposed to a lawyer who's really well intentioned, goes to legal aid, but comes from a more affluent background.
I don't know whether it's very difficult to say what another person can do, and I don't know whether I stand in a position where I can do that. I mainly focus on what I think I bring to it, and I do think that it aids me to have that. And that does not say that someone coming from another background cannot bring something else that also fosters or aid in this process, that the daily work that we do. So I'm not certain.
Let me jump in. I'm sorry, Hazel. Let me jump in here. We're coming up to a break. We are talking about how very personal experiences can lead us to our life's work and can find their way into our life's work, joined by Joy Franklin, editor of Asheville Citizen Times, and Hazel McHilliard, a lawyer in Winston-Salem. Just ahead, more of your calls, 1-877-962-9862. This is The State of Things. I'm Rusty Jacobs. We're talking this hour about life-altering experiences and how they may lead us to then personalize our careers. Joy Franklin, editor of the Asheville Citizen Times, joins us from Asheville. And we're also on the line with Hazel McHilliard, a lawyer in Winston-Salem. And we're taking your calls, 1-877-962-9862. And I'd like to start by hearing from Lori in Wake Forest. Hi, Lori.
Hi.
What's on your mind today?
Well, I just wanted to share that, unfortunately, I'm a parent that I lost my only child 9 years ago, and was having a very, very difficult time dealing with that grief. And back earlier, maybe about 6 or 7 months ago, I began leading a family bereavement support group in the Wake Forest, Franklin County area. And I think I have recovered and am healing now from my grief by doing that. And it has energized me to help these other parents.
How often are you involved with the bereavement group?
Well, we meet the third Thursday of the month, but during the month I reach out directly with these parents, and I spend a lot of time with them, either on the phone or we get together at each other's houses. I just sort of, become a mother hen with them, almost to a point.
I'm sorry, Lori, but I'm just curious. Do you do anything else professionally? Is there something is there a job you have, or have you even considered turning this into some kind of profession?
Well, this sort of is an outgrowth from a job that I had. In 1990, my daughter was 15 at the time and was in an automobile accident and was traumatically brain injured, and she was severely impaired. And I ended up going to work for the Brain Injury Association in North Carolina as a resource coordinator. And basically, I was an outreach person and would meet with the families when they, had, unfortunately, a family member with a brain injury, would sort of try to give them a roadmap of what was ahead of them, and did symposiums. I was, keynote speakers at different symposiums and conferences. So I've been able to use those tools that I brought from that career to what I'm doing now with
and
with
Lori,
the parents.
Let me ask you this, and I'd like to put this to the panelists as well, but are you ever too emotionally involved in what you do? I mean, does it ever become a hindrance as opposed to something that helps you do your work in bereavement?
Well, when my daughter died, I realized that at that time I could not continue the work I was doing for the Brain Injury Association. It would just be too difficult to deal with families and parents. But at this point, dealing with the families that have lost a child, I'm in their shoes. I'm walking in their shoes, and I understand what they're feeling and what lies ahead for them. Because as I said, it's been 8.5 years since I lost my daughter, and I was like, I'm not getting better. I'm not healing. And so I think I'm able to share that with them.
Well, Lori,
and see sort of the potholes that they have ahead of them.
Thanks so much for calling, Lori, and sharing that story. So, Hazel McHilliard, I just want to know, I mean, it's a much different experience you had in terms of, you know, that not so much a traumatic event that got you into where you are, but what about you? Is there too much emotional involvement in having lived, coming from poverty, now dealing with clients who experience that?
Sometimes you get close. I'm lucky to have a great husband. He helps me out with that. But you back up, and refocus and make sure you're on track. So that can happen from time to time. You need to check yourself.
Right. Just enough time to take one more quick call. Carol in Chapel Hill, just have about 20 seconds to tell us what you're calling about.
Hi, I'm a tutor of dyslexic children, and I began tutoring when I was homeschooling my son, who is also dyslexic. I have a daughter that has similar challenges. And while I believe that my my experience has helped my abilities with these families, I also see the points at which it can become a challenge to maybe impose what has been my experience on those families and not see those children or families for the unique situation that they're in. So I work with that.
Right. Carol, thanks so much for calling Joy Franklin. Why don't you tell me in about 10 seconds the downside of mixing the personal with the professional?
Well, I think I don't quite know yet. You know, as editor of an editorial page, which is what I do, it is my job to write opinion. And so I do that on a regular basis.
Joy, I'm going to have to jump in here. I'm sorry, we're just out of time. Thanks so much.
Okay.
And thanks to Hazel McHilliard, also a lawyer in Winston-Salem. Joy, that's Joy Franklin. She joined us from the studios of WCQS. It was 1939 when the Blind Boys of Alabama started singing gospel. They were just kids then, attending a school for the blind in Alabama. The group still performs the old gospel styles, like Jubilee singing. But now they're playing for new audiences. The group won back-to-back Grammy Awards in 2001 and 2002, taking songs by the likes of Tom Waits and Prince and reclaiming them in the name of gospel. Lead singer Clarence Fountain says there's no contradiction here. This is how he describes the music in his own words.
Clarence Fountain here, lead singer from the Blind Boys, from way down in Alabama.
Man, I can see, but I got somebody looking up for me.
You got two eyes, you know. There's a natural eye that you see me, but I don't see you, but in my mind I got an image of you. So that's the spiritual eye. If you can't see that, then you ain't got no eye at all. The other eye ain't no good either.
Can't see the sun that shines so bright. Can't see the moon that comes out every night. It doesn't make a difference to me, but it's important to me. My Savior's face I'll see. Then I can see. But I got somebody looking after me.
Jubilee singing is just like singing rap. Back in the old days, we used to sing that all the time in the Jubilee style of gospel. Well, my God got anger up on his throne. The angels in the heaven, they begin to moan. Sent out a raven, and he sent out a dove. But the water, great God, kept a-coming from above. Now, you take that and put it in rap style. Well, my God got anger up on his throne. The angels in the heaven, they begin to moan. Said, go down, angels, stir up a flood. Blow out the moon, change the sun into blood. Well, come back, angels, and bar the door. For the time has been, won't be no more. Ain't nothing but the same thing. We're just rapping in tune, and they're rapping out of tune.
Well, stop, great God, let me tell you the news. My head got wet in the midnight dew. I've been down on my bending knees, talking to the man from Galilee. Then my God spoke and he sounded so sweet. I thought I heard the shuffle of angels' feet. Then he put one hand upon my head. Great God the mighty, let me tell you what he said.
Don't tell that long-tongued liar.
First thing we listen, and we listen to the lyrics, and see do the lyrics fit the blind boys. If we got a song that I love my baby, and my baby loves me, we take that line out and say I love the Lord, and the Lord loves me. The song that we take and the song that we claim, listen to the words, and you can understand where we come from.
People get ready, there's a train of coming.
The man that wrote the tune was a religious man. He might be the first one we see when heaven comes down to us. He might be the first one that's there. Who knows? He sung the blues, but in his heart, he wrote gospel. Listen to the words.
People, get ready. There's a train coming. Don't need no baggage. You just get on. All you need is faith to hear the Jesus humming. Don't need no ticket, you just thank the Lord.
When the civil rights was going on, they beat them, put the dogs on them. What they done? Kept on walking. Didn't stop. So that's where the line come from. Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around.
Ain't gonna let nobody
turn me around.
Man can't turn around. God can, but man can't. So I'm gonna keep on walking. I'm gonna walk on down this freedom road.
I'm gonna keep on walking. Keep on talking. Walking down freedom road.
I know I got good religion.
Oh, yeah.
I did.
Mind is strengthened that I'll see God. I mean, literally see him with the natural eye. When I walk in heaven, I'll be whole. Won't nothing be wrong with me. I'll be able to see. I'll be able to do the thing that I couldn't do on earth. So, hey, I'm looking for the day.
Maybe the last time we fellowship together.
A couple of us have already gone. You don't know when your time is up. Nobody don't know that. If you knew that, you'd be ready. Lord, I'm ready now. Take me.
Be the last time, children.
But you don't know.
Be the last time.
Never know.
It may be the last time. I don't know.
Clarence Fountain, lead singer of the Blind Boys of Alabama. We heard from him as part of Musicians in Their Own Words, a series produced by David Shulman and supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The Blind Boys of Alabama will perform this weekend as part of the Carolina Union Performing Arts Series at UNC Chapel Hill. For more information, go to our website, the State of Things page at wunc.org. Last week, Krispy Kreme parted ways with embattled CEO Scott Livengood. This latest piece of bad news got our commentator Justin Catanozzo thinking about the city that spawned the once renowned but now ridiculed donut maker, Winston-Salem.
Is there possibly another community in the state that has suffered more body blows to its economic kingpins over the last quarter century, only to pick itself up, dust itself off, and eagerly prepare for the next round of the fight? I don't think so. It's hard to remember this, I know, but through the first three quarters of the last century, Winston-Salem was among the most prosperous, self-reliant cities in the Southeast. It was the birthplace of some of the country's best-known and most successful companies in textiles, tobacco, aviation, and banking. Think about it. Haynes Textiles, R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company, Piedmont Airlines, and Wachovia all flourished side by side for generations in one small city in the Triad. In fact, Winston-Salem was so self-reliant and confident in the durability of its economic engines that as late as the mid-1980s, business leaders there actually told commerce officials in Raleigh not to send new companies their way. They didn't think they needed them. At the time, the city didn't even have an active economic development program. Then came the body blows. Haynes Textiles went down first, taken over by Sara Lee in the late 1970s with the corporate headquarters moved to Chicago. Piedmont Airlines was taken over by U.S. Airways in the late 1980s, and hundreds of executive jobs were lost to Pittsburgh. Around the same time, RJR was wrestling with the barbarians at the gate in what was then the largest leveraged buyout in corporate history. The impact was devastating. Reynolds didn't move, it just shrunk. Once Winston-Salem's largest employer, the company has shed more than 8,000 of the best-paying jobs in town. Then a few years ago, Wachovia, venerable old Wachovia, the one founding giant that survived the economic calamities of the late 1970s and 1980s, was taken over by First Union, which hijacked the bank's name and moved thousands of executive jobs and executive influence to Charlotte. Business leaders in Winston-Salem would be forgiven for not picking themselves off the mat after so many vicious knockdowns, but for the past 15 years, that's exactly what they've done. The city, which once saw no need to plan ahead, has been diligently executing a strategic vision plan devised in 1990. The future now turns on healthcare, biotechnology, and advanced manufacturing. It's no accident that the Wake Forest Baptist Hospital Medical Center has grown to become the city's largest and most influential employer. Wake Forest and its medical school are now the big engines driving the Winston-Salem economy. That's by design. In fact, the university is now developing one of the largest urban research parks in the country. The promise of that park helped attract a pioneer in artificial organ generation from Harvard. The park also houses Targacept, a fast-growing pharmaceutical company that just happens to be the state's most richly financed biotech startup. And then there's Dell. Sure, Winston-Salem put far more money out in incentives to win the high-profile computer-making plant, but the business park that Dell selected was purchased by Winston-Salem leaders several years ago with the express purpose of attracting an advanced manufacturing operation, just like Dell is planning. For a while there, it looked like the ascendancy of homegrown Krispy Kreme donuts was going to offset some of the corporate losses of the past. But just like its once powerful, big-name neighbors, Krispy Kreme is on the ropes and possibly heading toward bankruptcy. Not surprisingly, Winston-Salem leaders aren't reeling. They've been in this fight before. They've been battered and bruised, but they've learned the importance of being resilient, and they know how to keep on swinging.
Justin Catanozzo is the executive editor of the Triad Business Journal. That's the state of things for today. Thanks for listening. Our show is produced by Jordana Gustafson and Corey Princell. Dave DeWitt edits the show. The director is Keith Weston. Robin Copley and Al Wadarski are the technical directors. The senior producer is Susan Davis. Fred Wasser is executive producer. If you have a comment about our show, drop us an email here at sot@wunc.org. Support for the State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I'm Rusty Jacobs.